On this week's 51%, you'll hear about women who are changing the game, literally or figuratively. First, the literal, as in developing video games.
First change I'd make is giving the female characters more armor, because in a battle situation, a bikini made of metal is not going to save you. I'm sorry, but that's just not logical.
Then a female farmer fights for land use, a teenager grows wary of lipstick ingredients, and an essay about changing a human brand. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Female gamers do not always have it easy in the virtual world, but, as Rhiannon Corby reports, they are finding ways to combat sexism in video game culture.
A big part of being a woman in gaming culture is dealing with people who don't want you there. Just ask any woman who games online.
Oh, are you hot? You know, where do you live? How old are you? Are you single?
You're too pretty to, like, game.
Kept telling me that he wanted to have sex with me. Oh, I'm a girl. They're like, oh, go back to the kitchen.
If 9 times out of 10, I have a good experience, that's great. But that one time, if I have some guy that's just saying awful things, if that even happens 1 time out of 10, for me, it's not worth it.
That last voice you heard is Steph McDonald. In college, she got into a game called Team Fortress 2, where you can chat in real time with other players. Initially, she was pretty open about her gender online. But the harassment she would get when other players realized she was a girl just got overwhelming. So she made some changes to her profile.
I just stopped using my microphone. I would just type in stuff into the chat box. You know, just try to be very neutral in, like, the things I would say so that my gender wouldn't be given away.
For most of video game history, games have been created by and for men. Just think back to what early gaming products were called. You've got Pac-Man, Mario Brothers, Game Boy. But as long as there have been video games, there have been women that play them. Over the years, a lot of women have opted for Steph's approach of flying under the radar. But there are downsides.
I think that there are a lot of amazing friendships that can come out of online gaming, but it's hard to connect with people if you kind of feel like you're having to lie about who you are.
I always play as a female character.
That's Kale Simpson. She's short and she looks like a pixie. Right now, she's in her college dorm room in Bangor, Maine, playing League of Legends.
Overall, right now, we are winning, it looks like. We're not winning our lane, but it seems everyone else is. Yep. Our tower's down. Like, say one of my teammates was like, come on, guys, let's go do this. And I'll be like, hey, I'm actually a girl. I'm not going to get through to the people who already have this really stubborn opinion. But I'm hoping that in trying to confront them, I'm making it like, oh, this isn't like a boys' club anymore. Be careful of what you're saying.
Kale plays as Morgana, a character known as the Fallen Angel. She's got spindly, tattered wings, and she spouts pink fire from her fingertips. Morgana looks cool, sure, but there's more to Kale's choice than just that.
The more female characters there are, the more normalized it is to see females inside of a video game that aren't non-playable characters.
Non-playable characters. It's just what it sounds like. Computer-generated characters that players can interact with, but not inhabit. And when you do see female characters in games, they're often non-playable. Take the Grand Theft Auto series. Up until the most recent version of that game, there was no option to play as a female character at all. And most of the women you see in the game are still non-playable. Prostitutes you hit with your car for points, or strippers you hire for a lap dance. In 2006, Nintendo introduced Wii, a new gaming console. Commercials for Wii showed men and women of all ages gaming together. The message was clear. This new gaming product was for everyone. So why do female gamers still have such a hard time?
It's becoming more evident that the problem is that women in games don't have a place in development.
Today, almost half of all gamers are female. But only 11% of game designers and 3% of programmers are women. Mainstream game distributors still make it difficult for women to get their foot in the door. But Kale points out a solution.
Most of the games that are being made female-friendly are independent developers. That's where most female developers that I've seen end up going because they have their own rules. They don't get harassed by their coworkers, at least in their workspace. No one is undermining their work.
And if you have women with the freedom to develop the kind of games they want, the games start to look a little different. A lot of independent games feature strong, playable female characters.
For instance, like Transistor, huge indie game, female protagonist, who is not sexualized whatsoever.
Transistor topped bestseller lists when it was released back in May. The protagonist is a woman named Red, for her bright red hair. She's elegant, beautiful, and she's a powerful fighter in her own right. So this brings us to another coping mechanism. If you don't like the game, you change it.
I can model characters on software, I can animate characters, and I can put them into the video game.
I'm in a game development class at Bangor High School with senior Rebecca Hamlin. Rebecca is one of four girls in her class, four girls and 24 boys. So she's thought a lot about how to make the visual aspect of gaming more appealing to women.
First change I'd make is giving the female characters more armor, because in a battle situation, a bikini made of metal is not going to save you. I'm sorry, but that's just not logical.
Have you worked on female characters?
I modeled one last year, and so when I went to make my character, I was like, she will not be ridiculous. She will not be this Amazonian, like, perfect supermodel.
Female gamers are gaining ground, as players in online gaming forums and in development. And as more women take development into their own hands, the more games reflect the characters and worlds women want to inhabit. So who knows? Maybe one day you'll run into Rebecca's character in a video game. Just be on the lookout for someone who fits this bill.
Well, the armor has stacked shoulder plates, and she of course has a sword, because those are fun to make. She has bracers on her arms.
For Salt Radio, I'm Rhiannon Corby.
Crossing leather straps across her chest and a plate in the middle.
Another change is happening, and it's because of Julia, a young organic farmer in Germany's Berlin. She says big companies that have nothing to do with food are buying the land she needs to produce the local organic food her customers want. And Julia and her fellow farmers are fighting back. Michael Scutoro explains.
The music you're hearing is from a film that young farming activist Julia Bartal and her colleagues recently made. In the film, Bartal is dressed like a reporter, telling the story of genetically modified seeds and land grabbing. Her fellow actors are dressed like German businessmen, gray trench coats and all. The action is set in Berlin's futuristic central train station. The movie might look glib, but its point, Bartal says, is to make it clear to people who buy organic food that if they don't support young organic farmers, they're not going to get the products they want.
For the land grabbing, for example, there was no awareness in the city. So we go to the city, we make actions, we make publications as well and so on for people to understand. Because we market our food directly to Berlin, it's like all of these people who eat the food that we produce are connected to this farm. And when we make an action and say, look, this is what's happening to us, this is the land grabbing that's happening to us as an example, but this is happening all over East Germany, then people get an awareness.
Bartal says that one of the issues at play here is that companies in completely other lines of business, like eyeglass chain Fielmann, are looking for a place to park their profits. Their purchases of land picked up considerably over the past 6 years in the midst of the Eurozone crisis in southern Europe. That's because farmland offers a better return on investment in the face of low interest rates. Some companies actually try to keep the land organic, and this is the case with Fielmann. But other companies like KTG Agrar are growing corn for biofuels. KTG owns about 40,000 hectares of land in eastern Germany. That's about the size of the city of Vienna. Bartal says that much of the land being sold by the government was once collectively owned farmland in the former East Germany. She says the land belongs to the nation, and that it should be held in a trust, rather than simply sold off to the highest bidder. She says what's going on in eastern Germany resembles the land grabbing that has taken place in Latin America and in Africa. But in Eastern Germany, it's an especially touchy issue.
On the land grabbing issue, talking about East Germany is a specific thing. People don't know the term land grabbing when they're talking about Europe. They know it from the countries of the South. This is happening in Latin America or in Africa or something. But in East Germany, we have a history of the socialist state. Then the wall came down. In the contract of the unification of Germany, without a public debate, they decided that they will privatize the land and the way how they will do it. There was never a public debate. We never had the chance to participate in that. And after the wall came down, first they just gave rent contracts to people. So that would be people who had always been living and maybe farming there. And that would be new businesses coming. And now this land is being privatized. So you have a vast amount of land that is suddenly being sold.
Bartal started her movement 2 years ago and has garnered a great deal of attention from local media and from politicians.
So when we started to put it on the agenda, like in the last 2 years as young farmers, like we created this network, the Confederation of Young Farmers, and we did a few actions as farms or as this network, it was like, boom, it was immediately in the media. It was all over. People were discussing it.
Some young farmers say that they want government cash grants or subsidies to be able to compete in the marketplace. But Kirstin Bernoth, an economist at Berlin's Hertie School of Governance, says Germany's farm industry already receives massive subsidies. The problem, as she sees it, is the way the money is being divvied up.
It's true that when you compare international statistics on how easy it is to start a company or a startup in Germany, we are not ranked in the top 10. We once analyzed in which sectors you actually observe the largest investment gaps in Germany. Agriculture is actually not the case, so because it's so highly subsidized.
But Willy Lehnert of a lobbying group in Berlin for organic farmers called FO with an umlaut L, says that the subsidies are going to the wrong people, to large industrial farmers. He's calling for a new program specifically aimed at helping young organic farmers.
First of all, you need capital, credit, and assets when applying for loans. It's easier now, thanks to low interest rates. But you still need a lot of cash, so we're calling for cash grants for young farmers. If I decided to start a farm in a small town, I'd need capital. So we're calling for grants of 25,000 euros for young organic farmers. We also want to make it easier for young farmers to get land. We, as an organization, don't want to buy the land. Rather, we want the government to lease the land. Land has become very, very expensive in Germany. It doesn't make sense to buy it. Young farmers should rent it from the state and save their working capital for running their businesses.
But Bartal says she thinks more drastic action is needed.
I think I would have a more radical approach. I think we should stop the selling of the land. The prices are completely disconnected from what you can regain through farming in your lifetime. So that makes it already impossible, actually, for somebody to buy it with money from farming.
Bartal and her group are calling for the German government to halt its land sales immediately. She then wants to see a new leasing scheme take hold, which would take into account young organic farmers' needs. She's also calling for community voting in cases where land is to be sold off. Michael Scuturo, DW, Berlin.
It's a weekly ritual for some women and girls stopping by the makeup counter to check out the latest beauty lines. At age 19, Youth Radio's Joy Morgan makes it her business to know what's in when it comes to the latest cosmetics. But only recently has she started to wonder about what kinds of chemicals she puts on her face, lipstick in particular.
One thing I know for sure, my friends and I count on the perfect lip gloss to set off our looks, whether we're heading to class or a night out. Right now, I'm totally into bubblegum pink. But I was surprised to learn, what's in these tubes? Polybutadiene dioxide?
I've never read the labels, the fine print.
I don't know how to say that.
I didn't know there was instructions on that.
Mica retinis communis? Oh, I know that one. That's castor oil.
Yeah, it definitely matters. I mean, it's on your mouth, so you're automatically going to be putting that in your mouth, and ultimately it's going to affect you.
Teenage girls spend nearly $14 a month on cosmetics, more than even their 18 to 24-year-old peers, according to a recent Youth Beauty Market report. That's one reason why researchers at the University of California, Berkeley, collected popular lip products from a youth group in Oakland. Dr. Catherine Hammond, an environmental health scientist, tested the lipsticks and glosses.
We were looking at 8 metals, and what we particularly found were that cadmium, chromium, manganese, and aluminum were present at levels that could actually rise to the level of some concern.
Consumer advocacy groups and the Food and Drug Administration, the agency that regulates makeup, have both found lead in cosmetics, but disagree about whether the concentrations are harmful or not.
So the fact that these metals were there doesn't surprise me. I had some suspicion that they might be. On the other hand, that they actually reach the levels where we might be concerned, that did somewhat surprise me.
The Personal Care Products Council stands by the safety of their products. But as a teenager who wears a lot of makeup, how much metal am I actually exposing myself to?
On average, maybe a person uses it 2 to 3 times a day. Mm-hmm. You know, average is just an average of many numbers, but nobody's average, right?
Right. It's just I have a feeling I'm way beyond average. When it comes to maintaining my look, it takes more than 2 to 3 touch-ups. I wanted to be sure, so I walked around with a bulky recorder and mic around my neck, looking like a dork for a couple of days, capturing every time I put on my lip gloss.
Testing, 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 testing.
I was sitting on the couch in my living room, getting ready to walk out the door in the morning, when I applied a pretty pink punch shade for the first time.
What you know about me? What you know? They said my lip gloss is popping. My lip gloss is too. All the boys keep jocking. They chase me at the school.
Okay, so I'm on dark right now, and I just had some cookies, so that caused me to reapply my lip gloss. This is reapply number 3, it is 11:45.
It's before noon, and I've already hit the average.
Okay, it is 4:10. I just had some ice cream from Rite Aid, so I have to reapply again.
I reached 11 lipstick touch-ups by the end of that Friday night. And on Saturday, when I kept track again, I reapplied 20 times, which is the norm for a night out with my girls. But these two ladies at the hair shop across the street from my office, Rashida and Gracie, stomped my average.
How often would you say you apply your lip gloss?
On a good day where I think I'm looking real good, I'll say maybe every hour.
Because my profession calls me to talk so much. I'm a mother and I talk so much and I eat. So I probably apply my lip gloss every 30 minutes, seem like.
I guess kids aren't the only heavy users. How much is too much? I asked the Food and Drug Administration spokesperson on cosmetics, Tamara Ward.
One of the things that we like to make sure consumers know is, unlike drugs, cosmetic products do not receive pre-market approval. The manufacturer is responsible for making sure that their product is safe, and we will step in when we know that there is an issue with a cosmetic product.
Seems like the only directions on the side of my lip gloss are apply as needed.
Well, the label is saying as needed.
Mm-hmm.
So as needed is vague, but it is the choice of the consumer.
I get that as my choice. Well, at least now, in California, the Department of Public Health has set up a website to actually tell us what's in our lipstick and shampoo. So maybe I'll take that information to the cosmetic aisle the next time I'm looking for a new shade of Baby Doll Pink Lip Gloss to match the bronzy gold around my eyes.
Show me your lip gloss.
For Living on Earth, I'm Joy Morgan in Oakland.
You are the boss. Christian Dior, take them to class. 18 shades of Clinique, long lost. The Mac, the cover girl. Revlon, origin. The Mac, the cover girl. Revlon, origin. Use this plumpy dad for your lip. Lick your lip like a magolin chick. That lip gloss and no sold in a store. Every girl I said long from the roof to the tip. Wind your waist like you and broke your hip, me. Ready for it, lingerie and get ripped. Girl, bend your back like the college neck clip. She said it's sweeter than cornflakes, honey dip. The Mac, the cover.
While we're on the subject of looks and the prices to be paid, writer Dr. Jerry Burns offers her take on societal reaction to people as unchanging brand. She says it's time to face the music.
Let's face it. Faces matter. But why must they matter so much? The actor Renee Zellweger faced the music last autumn because her face looks different than it used to look. This ignited a bonfire of speculation about whether she had work done. Miss Zellweger indicates that her changed look reflects nothing more than a healthy change in her lifestyle. Jennifer Gersonofilosi of The Guardian doesn't wonder what's wrong with Miss Zellweger's appearance, but rather what's wrong with us for making such a big deal about it. That's a good question. Steve Rose, also from The Guardian, suggests that a performer's face can be his or her brand. And a brand has predictability. It's what consumers expect. That's why we want that boxed cereal to taste exactly the same every time we open it. So, generally speaking, by branding actors' faces, it suggests that those faces mustn't change. The only problem with this is that human beings are designed to shift and morph. Change is a biological imperative. The world marches on, and the passage of time is etched into our souls and onto our faces. I'm on the brand wagon about this celebrity issue because branding performers bothers me in certain contexts. Expecting actors to remain youthful and unchanging saturates society with a desire to freeze the world at the age of 23. The personal and societal consequences of this addiction to perpetual youth, not to mention Photoshopped standards of beauty, has been expressed 1,000 times over. The fountain of youth is an unattainable holy grail that distracts us from what's really important. We all know that. But branding does something more. It can handcuff performing artists by preventing them from exploring new terrain and growing their art. I know a marvelous storyteller who shares funny tales about his life as a kid. He performs semi-regularly at a particular storytelling festival. One year, he told a serious, long-form story about an important historical figure. Though it was a beautifully crafted piece, with golden thematic threads linking past and present, the audience didn't accept it. They couldn't hear it for the art it was, not because it wasn't good, but because it wasn't faithful to his brand. His trademark goofball antics were not part of the piece. So the storyteller was stuck with his brand, whether he liked it or not. A humorist doing drama? It takes time for audiences to warm up to that, if they ever accept it at all. Audiences are powerful. That is why artists strive to connect with their audiences. But here is the heart of my concern. Do artists connect to audiences as brands or as artistic people? Can artists be authentic if they are hog-tied to their brand? It is certainly true that branding is important in business, and the performing arts are a business. Still, while branding can help a performing artist connect with the right audiences, it can also be limiting. Creativity needs to exist outside the box, inside the box, without the box, and anywhere else it wants to be. If branding locks people up in a box, creativity may not thrive. And if artists are hampered, then what they bring to their audiences suffers. So what can we do? Whether people are celebrities or not, we can applaud the changes that life brings instead of sniggering at them. We can fashion brands for performing artists that incorporate change as part of the brand, so that life and artistic transformations are anticipated and appreciated. Even though the arts are a product and art is a business, artists are not boxes of cereal. The signature of the arts is growth, development, and change. If artists don't try new things, their work suffers. And so does art. Branding can stifle creativity. It certainly caused quite an uproar when one woman was altered by time, surgery, or lifestyle changes. Let's allow Ms. Zellweger, other performing artists, and everyone else be who they need to be. There's no need to brand people like cattle. We can remain open to what they have to offer. See, there's beauty in change and delicious depth in the lines that mark the passage of time. Come on, society. Let's do an about-face. Let's not snigger, but applaud for that.
Dr. Jerry Burns is a storyteller, writer, and educator living in New York's Hudson Valley. You can find her at storycrafters.com. And that marks the passage of time for our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1334.